Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading from the May 2025 issue. Last time, I had begun reading when the battle's lost and won, Shulamith Firestone and the Burdens of Prophecy by Audrey Wolin. Just to recap a little bit, Shulamith Firestone was a Canadian-American radical feminist, writer, and activist. She published The Dialectic of Sex, The Case for Feminist Revolution. This became an influential text in feminist theory. Following her retirement from activism, Firestone was diagnosed with schizophrenia, which she lived with until her death in 2012. Her final published work was Airless Spaces, released in 1998. The book is a collection of short stories based on her experiences with mental illness. I'll continue now reading the Harper's article. Airless Spaces culminates in a portrait of Firestone's brother, a story titled Danny. In this story, his name is the beginning of communicable reality. The first word out of my mouth was Danny, and his death marks the end of the narrator's sustained relationship with sanity. Born less than a year apart, the siblings were estranged in their adult lives, yet twined in their desire for a life of extreme discipline and sublime self-fashioning. Before his death by suicide in 1974, Daniel had given up many of his possessions to live in a Zen Buddhist center. While The Dialectic of Sex closes with a version of Earth as it is in heaven, Airless Spaces closes with a paranoid fixation on the hereafter that gradually dismantles Firestone's here and now. She writes, "In the end, theories about his death, whether murder or suicide, afterlife or no, contributed to my own growing madness, which led to my hospitalization, medication, and a shattering nervous breakdown. The future reappears only this time to haunt." Psychotherapy makes storytelling a kind of remedy. So did the consciousness-raising groups that Firestone passionately participated in during her political years. Airless Spaces, however, complicates the idea that speaking one's truth can lead to liberation. It jostles between depicting people at their most atomized, outside consensus reality or social contracts, and their most blurry and indistinct. An accidental collective emerges, the category of fellow outcasts, those Firestone dubs losers, a term as variable, crackling, and ultimately political as woman. Every chapter is an individual, with titles like Ellis Martin Sheen, Leon Felcher, Ellen Ruby, Deborah Doherty, Stanley Moss, etc. And the book itself draws up a circle of folding chairs, giving everyone their turn to speak. Some dawdle, roll their eyes, murmur strange details, or complain like a drizzle. But almost every story elucidates a material condition. One wonders whether Firestone, by reassembling her memories of herself and her peers, is staging an imaginary consciousness-raising session in the living room of the page, or whether she is questioning the efficacy of the confessional mode as a political tool, thrusting it back into a more aesthetic register. The book disrupts its own curative wish by lingering with those who will never be well again, and if the narrow borderland of the chapter break or page turn connects the characters, it also holds them apart. How one enters the category of loser, and by extension, the disjointed collectivity of the text itself, is almost always an issue of aesthetics, style, and surface. Perhaps this is why Airless Spaces had to be a work of fiction and not of theory. It required Firestone to collaborate with beauty in order to reveal its terrors. For Firestone's outcasts, fashion and physical appearance in general takes on world-shattering importance. This is, in its way, a book about clothes, their ability to salvage or wreck the teetering self. It's about how a bad haircut or the wrong pair of jeans can destroy your life. Just as Firestone isolates the moment of skin-to-skin contact that provides vanishing consolation, she is masterful at pinning down the point when a character began to look like a mental patient, not an attractive woman who just happened to be thrown into a mental hospital. Firestone zeroes in on the small, painterly details that make someone alien to the mainstream, the seemingly minor decisions that pull someone out of the zone of conventional empathy. Her descriptions are so visual, they read almost like the text of a fashion magazine. The first time I was wearing square-cut 40 shorts in light blue, which were flattering, she writes in the story Sheldon Krim. But the second time, some 10 years later, I was wearing a dingy postal blue V-cut cardigan, which was considerably shabbier. Note the difference in blues, the way Firestone uses color to tell us the story of the missing decade. Clothes are also used as shorthand for one's degree of mental well-being. In the story, The Jumpsuit, a patient named Anna begs an orderly for a white sweatsuit. She felt like a bride wearing it, one of two competing brides. The cleanliness of her suit impresses the doctors, whereas the rival bride had gotten a soup stain on her sweatpants, washed the bottom to gray, and now could no longer wear the sweatshirt and sweatpants together. It works. Anna gets out. On the other side of the hospital walls, however, when she tried to wear her dazzling white sweat outfit in late November, she looked like an escapee from a loony bin rather than a high fashion model. The psychiatric notion of appropriate girlhood, clean, matching, purposeful, fails to translate in the outside world. The rules change. Sanity, like gender, is a moving target. Firestone's past life as a feminist thinker is never directly disavowed in these stories. The movement is mentioned here and there, but it is kept on the sidelines. In an essay about airless spaces, the scholar Sian Nai writes of her feelings of depression about Firestone's plunge out of history, which the book records most poignantly when it is explicitly not recording it, when it is conspicuously silent about how the hospitalized characters in it might have had political futures not entirely disconnected from their political past. Yet Firestone's political past was always oriented toward the future. Her plunge outside history, a phrase Nye borrows from Invisible Man, is more like a stepping into linear time, always stifling, and especially so in the reactionary hypercapitalism of the 80s. The loud presence of feminine's absence reverberates throughout the book, but I think this is how most women live, their edges drawn by the shuddering negative shape of their own unmanifested uprising. The only chapter in Airless Spaces in which feminism vividly careens into view is I Remember Valerie, a story about Valerie Solanas, the author of Scum Manifesto, who shot Andy Warhol in the midst of her own schizophrenic breakdown. The two women do not like each other. When Firestone visits Valerie, after she had moved just a block away from me since her release from Matawan, an institution for the criminally insane, I found her in an apartment better than mine. Valerie tells her, "I didn't like your book." In turn, Firestone confides in the reader, "Frankly, I thought it was a big mistake to recognize Valerie as one of us, a women's liberationist, let alone to embrace her book as serious feminist theory." Still, there is a begrudging sympathy. Valerie waxed paranoid about how the media was out to get her. Firestone thought maybe it was true. It is easy to project desires onto I Remember Valerie, particularly the desire for Firestone and Solanas to recognize what they have in common, to form a bond. It is tempting to read into the small glimpses of solidarity displayed in the story. Maybe it was true. Were these the demons of killer psychosis, or did she just have a bad case of bronchial pneumonia and shouldn't be on the street, and such? But ultimately, I Remember Valerie, like many stories in Airless Spaces, is about witnessing someone's disillusion into poverty and mental illness and not being able to help them. Firestone doesn't visit her again and is too afraid of her to invite her into my sublet when she encounters Solanus panhandling by St. Mark's Place. Later, she hears that Solanus has been begging for shelter, covered with sores and wearing only a blanket, until she finally disappeared from the street entirely. Firestone never attempts to absolve herself of her failure to extend further kindness to Solanus, and yet there is some elusive solidarity event in the title, a first-person declaration of another's fleeting existence. I Remember Valerie. That's a feminism I recognize, a refusal to forget, a shining mark where something or someone was once erased, a monument built around the emptiness where a revolution might have sparked and burned. The hypothetical world of the dialectic of sex was predicated on the existence of technology that didn't exist in 1970. Firestone's attitude toward the inventions she believed would create freedom is casual, presumptuous in the most endearing way, as if a parenthetical could do a Cher Horowitz shrug. The division of labor would be ended by the elimination of labor altogether through cybernetics. Duh. She envisioned constant networked connectivity, a system of socialized computer banks that would, among other things, democratize information, outsource memories, and problem solve. She predicted the quick advancement of reproductive medicine and called for artificial wombs. It all seemed outlandish and spurred outrage and mockery. But now, after successful experiments on sheep and pigs, the FDA is debating whether to approve human trials for artificial womb technology that would allow severely premature babies to continue developing in a biobag filled with lab-made amniotic fluid. One of the biggest bioethical concerns today is not that these trials will catalyze widespread feminist revolution, as Firestone had hoped, but that anti-choice organizations will harness the technology to prevent people from terminating their pregnancies. Offering a viable option for the survival of the fetus outside the human body could expand into enforcing such procedure, especially as notions such as fetal personhood become enshrined in law. 55 years after The Dialectic of Sex was published, our politics are riven by the very issues Firestone foresaw, but in drastically different arrangements of power than she could have anticipated. The social control of reproductive organs, their function, and their meanings, fertility techniques and their potential to disrupt traditional family structures, children's ownership of their own bodies, women's naturalized role as caregivers. I could be listing the talking points of a right-wing podcaster. Firestone was off by a mile as narrow as a hair's breadth. The witch's burden of prophecy is often shared with the revolutionary. Right in the wrong way, forced to weather the distorted echoes of conviction, a conviction that once felt transcendent. I am reminded of Firestone's dedication in The Dialectic of Sex for Simone de Beauvoir, who endured. Writing a manifesto can be like sewing rocks into your pockets. Disillusionment sounds as though the illusions suddenly disperse, like insects scuttling into corners when the overhead light flicks on, leaving a bare room behind with nothing but a dark fluttering at the edges. But convictions are hard to shake. They can harden, growing heavier as two futures diverge, or in this case, entangle. The better world you dreamed of, sitting on the floor in smoky living rooms, and the one that actually came to pass. Now I'll be reading Sleepless in Sophia by Tim Parks. This is from the Harper's regularly featured column, Easy Chair. For the first and very likely the last time in my life, I'm appearing on a primetime talk show in Bulgaria. I'm in the capital, Sofia, for a festival, and before I arrived, I was sent an article. Does Bulgarian literature have a place within world literature? The author, Amelia Lykova, also an organizer of the festival, expresses her concern that Bulgarian literature is far too national, provincial even. It doesn't tackle global issues. So here we go. The cameras turn to me, and after a few preliminary questions, the host asks, "Mr. Parks, you're English, but you've lived many years in Italy. You write for American journals, you translate, you know the international scene. Tell me, how can our Bulgarian literature survive in an English-speaking world?" I'm thrown. Does a country's literature rely on international circulation to thrive? Do they suppose I can tell them how to get a Bulgarian author nominated for the Nobel? Maybe, I suggest, writers should just tell the stories they feel moved to tell and that Bulgarians are excited to read. But this clearly doesn't cut it. Sitting in the studio with me are a former prime minister and the speaker of the National Assembly. They've been discussing declarations made by the Hungarian foreign minister about the European Union and Ukraine, or so the host whispered to me. The conversation was in Bulgarian. There's an awful lot I don't know here. Is a literary question tied up with anxiety about Bulgaria's continuing existence in the shadow of an expansionist Russia? Something the taxi driver explained to me on the way from the airport? At another moment, the host asks me how Bulgarians should react to the fact that George Bernard Shaw's play, Arms and the Man, recently staged in Sofia by none other than John Malkovich, depicts Bulgarians as a naive, militaristic people with poor hygiene. As he speaks and I reply, I hear the voiceover of a Bulgarian interpreter, which only adds to my sense of disorientation. I manage to remember that Shaw wrote his anti-war comedy in the early 1890s, setting it in a place neither he nor his audience knew anything about, precisely so as to say anything he wanted. He wasn't envisaging a tour of the Balkans. The host is undeterred, suggesting that if these comments were made about an African population, they would be considered extremely racist. Struggling to appear wise, I say I'm sure the Bulgarians are mature enough to smile at Shaw's misconceptions and enjoy the play for what it was meant to be. Later, sleepless in a ninth-floor hotel room, beside a window looking east across the city toward Turkey and the Black Sea, I wonder who has made more of a fool of themselves, me, accepting an invitation to a country I know nothing of in the vague hope they might translate my novels, which spring from a milieu they know nothing of, or them, supposing that inviting me could promote Bulgaria's status in some globalized literary arena. What would have been the proper response to the questions I was asked? Turning my pillow, I remember a remark by a Dutch friend, the essayist Bas Heine, that one effect of globalization is to make people in smaller countries think of their own culture as minor, inadequate. Let us no longer express ourselves in a local patois, the charismatic Dutch writer Gerard Reve proclaimed in the 50s, deciding to abandon his native language and switch to English. The Evenings, his Dutch language masterpiece from the previous decade, had failed to find a British or American publisher. But if writers look beyond their national community to appeal to a global audience, wouldn't that alter what they write? A book like The Evenings had a special effect in post-war Holland. While a fierce debate raged about Dutch collaboration with the Nazis, Reve's splendidly feckless protagonist was chiefly concerned about surviving a suffocating domestic life with his tedious parents, and though he relishes terrifying, sadistic fantasies, the war is barely mentioned, something critics at the time thought scandalous. For the Anglophone reader who picked up the translation when it finally appeared in English in 2016, this context was lost. Would Rebbe have written a different book if he'd decided to play his internationalist card earlier? Would it have been as good? His English language writing got him nowhere. So where does that leave the idea of world literature, now taught as a course subject in many universities? My mind goes back to Leikova's article. Reflecting on the ability to write globally, she offers a roadmap for new Bulgarian literature's development toward becoming world literature, listing the trends and tropes that promise international attention. Authors may focus on experiencing warfare and its effects on the lives of individuals, or their country's past and the issues of colonialism. She mentioned successful international practitioners, Kate Atkinson, J.M. Coetzee, V.S. Naipaul, as well as Herta Mueller and Svetlana Alexievich. Living under socialism is another promising topic, Leikova writes. Bulgaria threw off the communist yoke in 1990. One Bulgarian who ticked this box with success, she thinks, showing he knows how to broaden the ego and universalize it, Georgi Gospodinov. His novel, The Physics of Sorrow, which describes Bulgaria as this empty space between Istanbul, Vienna, and Budapest, was well reviewed internationally. An essential voice in world literature, claims this American publisher. His next novel, Time Shelter, which imagines a clinic in Zurich where people can take refuge in meticulous reconstructions of the past, won the International Booker Prize in 2023. As a rule, though, Leikova worries, even when Bulgarian novels do serve up the right subjects, she mentions terrorism, refugees, immigration, the cultural melting pot, they fail to notice global problems and instead look intently at the political and social problems of Bulgarian society. How bad is that? Fortunately, she reports, there is a way to focus on the national precisely in order to be published beyond national borders. You turn the logically or regionally specific into something exotic, like of a sites, Jhumpa Lahiri, Orhan Pamuk, and Khaled Hosseini, as celebrity examples, and mentions the success of the Bulgarian writer, Ruza Lazarova, who switched from her native tongue to the more international French, producing stories about her childhood that Bulgarian readers may find it difficult to identify with because they seem hyperbolized, inauthentic, and rather narrowly suited to the expectations of a foreign audience. Another Bulgarian, Miroslav Penkov, Leikova writes, won the BBC National Short Story Award for a story that presents his native Bulgaria as a place of unique, one might say weird, customs. In short, it's not easy to please both the home crowd and the away, and it's not always easy as a reader to know what to think. Is Elena Ferrante's Naples authentic, or, as one prominent Italian critic put it, a poster for tourists? And what about the Sicily of Andrea Camilleri, the country's other big literary export? A souvenir, complains another critic, the exotic, inauthentic idea that, say, an American from Dallas has of Italy. Is the reader of world literature essentially a tourist? This brings to mind something else to keep me awake. For some weeks now, I've been wondering whether to resign from a panel of judges granting residencies to writers. That is, the opportunity to concentrate on their writing in a pleasant environment with all expenses paid. The project is funded by a major American endowment, though it is open to writers the world over. In fact, as judges, we are aware that, although there are no quotas for nationalities or genders, a broad spread in the writers we select will be welcome. I'm thinking of resigning because so many of the applications are of a kind. Writers with a range of nationalities and ethnic backgrounds, though for the most part, residing in the United States and teaching at American universities, offering as their sample work a accounts of their or their parents' or grandparents' sufferings. Nothing wrong with that. But these unhappy tales form an astonishingly large proportion of the applications, rather as if the writers were following the Lykova-style roadmap that cited the grievances of the disgraced person as likely to appeal to the judges of international awards. Is this the scenario, then? That with so much of the world focused on America as the great driver of globalization, following American news, watching American films and TV, reading American books, American writers hardly have to worry about pitching their work to an international audience? In any event, the U.S. book market is by far the largest worldwide. Meantime, however, those from less privileged or peripheral countries who want to join the party are tempted to draw attention to their ethnicity or don national costumes to get international attention. It's a depressing thought, but I remember now, in Salman Rushdie's memoir, Joseph Anton, he describes how, as a young man who had spent much of his recent life in England, but who was disappointed with his failure to break through as a writer, he decided that his Indian identity would be his trump card and abandoned his London job in advertising to rediscover the country he had left years before. Later, he records his exultation at the Booker Prize dinner at which he opened a handsome, leather-bound presentation copy of Midnight's Children to find a bookplate inside that read Winner. That word does it. I'm not going to sleep. Is this what I've dedicated my life to? A game of winning or losing? Standing at the window, I see nothing recognizable, at least to me, on the Sofia skyline, but the victorious golden arches of McDonald's. A single recipe for all the world. In general, these are the words of the Italian poet Giacomo Leopardi, writing in 1820. You could say that the tendency of the modern spirit is to reduce the whole world to one nation and all nations to a single person. Even language is becoming the same for everyone thanks to the widespread propagation of, but here I have to smile, French. Is that where it all began? The battle for global supremacy between English and French? My wife has just published an article about a quarrel between Voltaire and the Italian Anglophile Giuseppe Baretti, a close friend of Samuel Johnson. Voltaire, who in the 1720s had admired Shakespeare and even translated parts of Hamlet, changed his mind after British victories over France in the Seven Years' War, gains that guaranteed Britain's hegemony in North America and India, hence, eventually, the world dominance of English. Poor France, Voltaire wrote, has neither navy, nor money, nor plate, nor fame, nor wit. In 1761, he published his Appel à toutes les nations de l'Europe sur des jugements d'un écrivain anglais, in which he declared Hamlet ridiculous and Shakespeare a man with no taste who ignored all the rules of theater, certainly no match for Corneille and Racine. Even if France was losing the war, it would maintain its cultural supremacy, Voltaire claimed. Baretti rushed to Shakespeare's defense with a 200-page book. In detail, he trashed Voltaire's translations from Hamlet, showing convincingly that the philosopher's English wasn't up to it, then went on to undermine the whole idea of world literature, even before Goethe pronounced in its favor in 1827. Voltaire's notion of a universally applicable taste, Baretti thought, was simply French taste applied to cultures with quite different mindsets, a form of imperialism. Even if Voltaire had had better English, Shakespeare wouldn't come across in French. Different countries had different tastes and always would. Shakespeare's English was so dense and brilliant that the only way to appreciate him was to learn English. Yes, my French messieurs, to know Shakespeare, you'll have to come to London. In this view, literature is predicated on belonging. It requires you to be part of a community. You can't decide who wins between Shakespeare and Corneille because there is no common measure of artistic achievement. Literature is not a playing field, let alone a battlefield. You can't expect to appreciate the literary achievements of every nation in the same way. The following evening, somewhat weary, I go to my main festival event, a conversation with Daria Karapetkova, a prominent Bulgarian translator and professor of literature. The crowd is encouragingly numerous and attentive. Later, I discover that many of them are Karapetkova's students, aspiring writers and translators. She asks me about the Nobel, recently won by Han Kang. Was it simply time to give the prize to a Korean? I say that all I know about Kang came from writing about her novel, The Vegetarian, and discovering, after feedback from Korean critics, that the English translation departed in very many ways from the original. The translator, Deborah Smith, had declared that faithfulness is an outmoded, misleading, and unhelpful concept. When the prestigious Italian publishers Adelphi Edizioni, having read the book in English, had it translated into Italian from the Korean, they rejected that version and, to get the book they thought they had acquired, had it translated from the English. Perhaps they should have given the Nobel to the translator, Karapetkova teases. Why not? Translators are eager for visibility, too. They like to insist a translation is an original work in its own right. However, I point out, we don't know which translation the Swedish judges read. The French version, for example, which I dipped into, is quite different. Perhaps in the end, world literature gives us the version of the world that suits us, that we can feel knowledgeable for having consumed. What advice, Karapetkova asks, because it's the inevitable closing question, would you give to Bulgarian writers? I would love simply to shake my head, but they've paid to bring me here. Write to the community you live and move in, I say. That's where the reading experience will be most intense. If your compatriots are enthusiastic, sooner or later someone will translate you, since the modern globalized individual cannot accept the idea that there is something excellent out there that they don't have access to, or can't turn into money, or measure against the other excellent things they already have, so as to hand out a prize. Even if translation is impossible, they will translate. In the audience, a hand goes up. A young man says he is translating a thriller that is not very good. Should he improve it? That's your call, I tell him, glad of the chance to mention the curious case of the Iranian translator Zabihullah Mansouri, who, from the 20s to the 80s, claimed to have translated 1,400 books, including many of literature's great masterpieces, systematically improving them with his own additions and reflections to suit an Iranian public. He became very popular. You are listening to articles from the May 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. The next piece I'll be reading is A Millennial Saint, The Canonization of Carlo Acutti by Emily Harnett. It is roughly 3 o'clock in the afternoon in Assisi, and the chapel of St. Mary Maggiore is thronged with pilgrims. I hover above them, watching via a camera perched discreetly on the ceiling. The camera points down at a white casket. On the side of the casket is a window, through which I can see the body of a teenage boy, his jeans, his Nikes, his navy track jacket. The pilgrims proceed single file past the boy, who has been dead now for many years. As they pass his casket, some of them brush their fingers across it tenderly. They will do this until nightfall, when the tomb will be closed to visitors. It will remain open, however, to everyone on the internet, as it is all hours of the day, every day of the year. I discovered this by accident several months ago. I had viewed the live stream from the tomb of the blessed Carlo Acutti early one morning, only to realize later that night that I had never closed the tab. It was one among many left over from the day. Gmail inbox, Twitter feed, Amazon cart, child's tomb. And I clicked on it with a certain feeling of unease. When the room reappeared before me, I was startled by its emptiness. Though the lights in the chapel were dim, the casket was backlit and bright. I studied what I could of Carlo through my monitor and the window into his coffin. Nothing moved in the chapel or in my browser, save the endlessly updating chat room scroll of strangers' pleas for his intercession. "Carlo, I'm suffering horribly," wrote someone with the username _crime_in_history. "Carlo, please grant me a wonder." Watching from the calm of my apartment, I couldn't help feeling like an intruder on the privacy of others' prayers, on the privacy of another's grave. The image was so still that I also began to doubt whether the video was actually streaming. Carlo was an absolutely normal boy, insists the copy on his official website, carloacuti.com. But given that Carlo would be named a Catholic saint, some would argue that he is one of the least normal boys ever to live, or, for that matter, to die. In canonizing him, the Church declares that we know with certainty, from our ignorant position here on earth, that he is in heaven. A devout Catholic who attended Mass daily, Carlo was also a coder, a gamer, and a millennial. His generation's first saint, he was born in 1991 and died in 2006 from leukemia when he was only 15. His formal canonization during the Church's Jubilee of Teenagers this April suggests that it is teenagers, or at least Generation Z, to whom the Church intends to prefer him as a role model. On TikTok, videos from his tomb have attracted hundreds of thousands of views and a chorus of bewildered commenters. "Hey, so this is insane. In the tracksuit is crazy. Bro, what?" Thank God for the Protestant Reformation. Part of the widespread fascination with the young saint stems from the fact that his canonization brings holiness into the third millennium, in the words of one of his hagiographers. He enters the canon less than 2 decades after his death, even though the process, on average, takes nearly 200 years. The vast majority of Catholic saints lived and died in a world we'd hardly recognize. The idea that a saint might know something of our time and something of our childhoods can be hard to wrap one's head around. Carlo celebrated his first communion 1 year after the premiere of South Park. His PlayStation could technically be categorized as a second-class relic, the Church's classification for a saint's personal belongings. Getting an extra 5,000 years in purgatory because it turns out I talked smack to Carlo Acuti in a Halo 2 lobby in 2004, one person joked on Twitter. I was born the same year as Carlo, and I remember having a general sense, growing up in a world with cable TV and high-speed internet, that no teenage boy would ever see heaven. According to the Church, Carlo entered the kingdom of God the same year that I snuck into a movie theater to see Borat without my parents. If it's true, as Catholics say, that all of us are called to be saints, no one I knew was answering that call in the 10th grade. The unlikeliness of such a contemporary saint has led to a staggering amount of enthusiasm for Carlo's cause. Since his beatification in 2020, Carlo has become the object of more popular devotion than many a veteran saint. In Chicago, there is a parish of the Blessed Carlo Acuti, and there's another of the same name in England. There's a shrine to him at a church in New Jersey that Carlo's mother furnished with an ornate reliquary containing a strand of his hair. Michael O'Neill, the self-proclaimed miracle hunter, who hosts a podcast and television show of the same name, keeps a relic of Carlo on his desk. As O'Neill explained on his podcast, Carlo, too, was a miracle hunter of sorts, one who used the web to further his work. Carlo has been touted as the patron saint of the internet and God's influencer, owing to his exhaustive efforts researching and cataloging Eucharistic miracles on his website. By elevating a teen coder to sainthood, the church suggests that science and technology need not be at odds with faith. In fact, this has long been the position of the Vatican. A miracle cannot be confirmed without the approval of scientific experts who help to validate the claims associated with each candidate for sainthood. The vast majority of those are miracles of a medical nature, and the Church holds that two miracles, when attributed to a specific candidate's intercession, offer proof that a saint really is with God in heaven. The other miraculous events and experiences that make up the wide world of Catholic spirituality, apparitions, levitations, bilocations, stigmata, and so-called moral miracles, rarely furnish the sort of evidence that would allow the investigators at the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints to rule out natural causes. Carlo's canonization, however, has come at an inflection point in the history of the miraculous, shortly before the Church confirmed the second healing miracle attributed to his intercession. The Vatican published a document overhauling its process for confirming supernatural phenomena, the first such revision since 1978. Some commentators suspect that the revised guidelines were, in part, occasioned by the decades-long controversy over Our Lady of Medjugorje, the inspiration for an immensely popular pilgrimage site in Bosnia, where in 1981, six people claimed to have seen and received messages from the Virgin Mary. The visionaries maintain that they have received prophecies, sometimes on an hourly basis, ever since. The Church has come to regard the phenomenon with some embarrassment, and last summer employed the new guidelines to render a long-awaited verdict nihil obstat. This judgment is not a confirmation of the visionary's supernatural claims, but a hedged endorsement of the site's devotional appeal. In effect, the Vatican's equivalent of, we can neither confirm nor deny. The Vatican's new classifications make possible such expressions of ambivalence. In any case, the guidelines will have the inevitable effect, one commentator writes, of disenchanting the world. By withdrawing authority to declare miracles from local officials, Rome ensures that there will be fewer miracles in the future. The internet era has thus become a less miraculous one, which would seem to belie the Pope's optimistic insistence that the internet is something truly good. So, in some respects, does the canonization of Carlo himself. In hagiographies, his adolescence unfolds in the sweetly declarative sentences of a picture book. He played soccer, he built websites, he played video games, he loved Jesus. He did many of the normal things that normal teenagers do, except, of course, grow up or get an Instagram account. He will remain forever in high school, forever in 2006. The simplicity of his childhood is, like his PlayStation and like his body, a relic from a different age. The patron saint of the internet never did so much as held an iPhone. God's influencer never knew what an influencer was. He never participated in a viral dance trend, never sent or received a Snapchat message, never surrendered his adolescence to powerful corporate algorithms. Ironically, only in death has he become what teenagers now are in life, eternally online. Carlo was the only child of Antonia Salzano and Andrea Acuti, a financial executive. But not long after his death, according to Antonia, Carlo appeared to her in a dream to inform her that she could once again expect to be a mother. 4 years to the day since Carlo's death, Antonia gave birth to twins. She was 44 years old. This story, repeated over the years in the press, is one of many miracles that have been attributed to Carlo since he died. In 2013, a 4-year-old boy with a severe pancreatic abnormality underwent a total and inexplicable recovery after touching a relic of Carlo. A few years later, a Costa Rican woman visited Carlos' tomb and prayed for her daughter, who had entered a coma after a traumatic bike accident. That same day, her daughter began to breathe on her own again. Scans of her brain showed that her hemorrhage had disappeared. What qualifies a person for the canon is their demonstration of what the Church calls heroic virtue. Once a local bishop takes up the cause for canonization, a Vatican investigator, called a postulator, is enlisted to draw a petition, a document detailing evidence of a candidate's heroic virtues. To compose a petition, which can be hundreds of pages long, the postulator enlists the help of historians or, if the candidate died within living memory, interviews those who knew him. What we know of Carlos' life, all 15 years of it, we know mostly from what his parents, classmates, teachers, medical team, and domestic staff have told either the press or the postulator during the preparation of Carlo's petition. Though he was born in London, Carlo grew up in Milan, as secular a city as you'll find in Italy. His parents were worldly, wealthy, and like many Milanese, Catholic only in the cultural sense. At the beginning of her memoir, My Son Carlo, Antonia writes that prior to Carlo's birth, she had been to Mass all of three times, for her baptism, her first communion, and her wedding. As a young child, however, Carlo peppered her with questions about Catholicism, to which he seems to have been introduced through the faith of his Polish nanny. To better answer her son's questions, Antonia began to educate herself in the religion of her birth. In her telling, she emerged from this belated catechesis a true believer, inspired by the unexpected piety of her young son. Later, Carlo began to attend Mass escorted by the family's Hindu housekeeper, who would later cite Carlo's devotion as the inspiration for his own conversion to Catholicism. Together, such stories of conversion and reconversion paint a portrait of a child who evangelized when he was still in elementary school. His passion for the Eucharist, what he is said to have called his highway to heaven, is the quality most often celebrated by his hagiographers. Only 30% of self-identified Catholics profess belief in the doctrine of transubstantiation, a fact that has long been a source of consternation in the Church. Toward the end of his life, Carlo prepared a presentation, later to be preserved on his website, on the history of Eucharistic miracles. These are the miracles that Michael O'Neill describes as his favorite kind. If you accept, for instance, that a consecrated host in Buenos Aires transformed overnight into the bloody tissue of a human heart in 1996, then you have to be Catholic. But belief in miracles seldom requires any such faith. One of the ironies of our broadly secular age is that while religion has waned in the Western world, belief in the supernatural has not. In 2008, the Pew Research Center found that nearly 8 out of 10 surveyed adults believe that miracles still occur today as in ancient times. And while the pews at Catholic churches have grown emptier, the demand for exorcisms, even among non-Catholics, remains high. O'Neill believes his programs can open the door to faith, in part because his own engineering background gives him credibility with skeptics and non-believers. But there is no easy correlation between one's acceptance of the supernatural and belief in a divinely ordered universe. You can have one, evidently, without the other. Even the Church doesn't require Catholics to believe in most of the miracles it approves. Classified as private revelations, they are not included in the deposit of faith. I wondered about the meaning of Carlo's canonization in a disenchanted age. Many of the most famous saints, including Carlo's beloved Saint Francis, were believed to possess extraordinary powers that would make them, in many ways, the total opposite of an absolutely normal boy. And yet Carlo is laid to rest in Assisi, where Saint Francis stripped naked and surrendered himself to God. In October, I traveled to Assisi with a pilgrimage group to visit Carlo's tomb on his feast day, the anniversary of his death, the first since the news broke of his impending canonization. The city remains an architectural time capsule of the Middle Ages. For an American tourist like me, more familiar with the scenic vistas of the New Jersey Turnpike, its basilicas and winding medieval streets are inexhaustibly beautiful. But for a normal Italian teenager, it is surely almost indescribably boring. Because its attractions are almost exclusively historical and spiritual, Assisi is not a place, in the words of our tour guide, where you go to have fun. It is a place you go to pray. According to his father, Assisi was Carlo's favorite place. In 2019, his body was exhumed and placed on display in the Church of St. Mary Maggiore. His tomb opened to the public in October 2020 for the church's 19-day celebration of his beatification, during which it received more than 41,000 visitors despite intense pandemic-related travel restrictions. Though he has been dead now for 19 years, he looks rosy-cheeked, pristine, and remarkably alive, owing to the silicone that the church has fitted over his face and hands. His lifelike appearance has led to some confusion. When his tomb first opened, breathless rumors began to circulate online that his remains had been discovered incorrupt. Eventually, the Archbishop of Assisi clarified that, although Carlo's body had been reassembled with art and love, his remains were found in the normal state of transformation typical of the cadaveric condition. Carlo's tomb has become a popular site for pilgrims, but most are drawn to Assisi, as Carlo had been himself, by devotion to Saint Francis. The pilgrimage in which I had enrolled promised to follow in the footsteps of Blessed Carlo Acuti, which was also to follow in the footsteps of the city's patron saint. To study the saints is to enter a hall of holy mirrors. Saints become saints by imitating other saints who themselves imitated Christ. The remains of Saint Clare, the founder of the order of nuns known as the Poor Clares, are also in Assisi. She was herself called to religious life by the example of Francis. Among the relics displayed in her basilica are coiled white blonde locks of her hair that look at a distance like vermicelli noodles. In the basilica that houses Francis's ugly, hulking stone tomb, his cassock is on display, along with bandages stained with his blood. The Cathedral of San Rufino, not far from where Carlo was laid to rest, contains a first-class relic taken from Carlo's heart. On the 18th anniversary of Carlo's death, my fellow pilgrims and I went to venerate the relic. It was quiet. Most of the feast day crowds were evidently at Carlo's tomb. San Rufino, which dates back to the 11th century, is not the most beautiful or the most significant of Assisi's scores of churches and chapels, but it eclipsed the grandeur of every Catholic church in America that I had ever known. Enormous paintings of Christ and the Virgin Mary hung from the walls, framed by scrolling masonry. Glass built into the floor showed the crumbling remains of Roman architecture beneath. Carlo's shrine stood off to the side, the reliquary protected behind a screen. Beside it hung the most familiar portrait of Carlo, in which he squints into the sun, half smiling in that way that teenagers do to indulge a parent behind the lens. We gathered in the pews before the shrine to pray a decade of the rosary, which I hadn't done since a religion class I took as a teenager. As we prayed, what I took to be a class of Italian middle schoolers shuffled by. They were not much younger, I realized, than Carlo had been himself at the time of his death. They giggled, kicked at one another's shoes, and, as we prayed, stared into our faces with a frank zoological curiosity. One boy, littler than the rest, whipped around and knocked over a candle with his backpack. A taller boy caught it midair and replaced it gently. They were not misbehaving, not really. They were just being preteens on a school trip, content in the knowledge that no one actually expected them to learn whatever it was they were supposed to be learning. Every now and then, one of them glanced at Carlos Relic with flat, unseeing eyes, as though at a street lamp. For the first time, I felt a kinship with Carlo. I knew nothing of his piety, but as a teacher, I knew very much what it was like to bore schoolchildren. After all, he was dead, and they were alive. It seemed that he was no more a part of their world than the old paintings that hung above us or the Roman ruins below. I lingered by the shrine for a few minutes longer, trying to estimate the size of a human heart, the number of relics it could yield if you sliced it as thinly as pages of a Bible, wondering whether a heart so divided would be diminished or multiplied. Then a boy of about 10, in a knit hat and a puffy coat, trotted up to the shrine. His father followed close behind. Together, we watched in silence as the boy, standing on tiptoe, reached up and spread his fingers against the glass as though to warm them by what lay on the other side. The Italians I meet love to remind people that St. Francis was ugly. It's true that medieval art doesn't do him any favors. The frescoes on the walls of his basilica depict him as a tiny man with enormous ears, the top of his tonsured head seemingly abashed by its own baldness. Francis is nevertheless one of the greatest Catholic saints. He is also Christianity's most famous stigmatist. 2 years before his death in 1226, marks appeared on his hands and feet, suggestive of crucifixion. These, along with the wound in his side that also matched Jesus, reportedly bled and caused him enormous pain. Receiving stigmata constitutes a miracle in Catholicism, and Francis was believed to possess several other miraculous powers. According to some accounts, Francis was able to levitate and appear in two locations at once. That's all we have time for today, so I will continue with A Millennial Saint, The Canonization of Carlo Acuti by Emily Harnett, next week. Thanks so much for joining me today for this episode of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, and I have been reading from the May 2025 issue. Please stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona for a wonderful selection of programming.